Welcome to This Is Your Life with Michael Hyatt, where our goal is to give you the clarity, courage, and commitment you need to do what matters. My name's Michelle Cachat. I'm your co-host today, and I'm sitting in the studio with Michael Hyatt. Hey there, Michael.
Hey, Michelle.
Well, the truth is as much as we try to plot out our life, as much as we try to get it to go according to plan, the unexpected always happens.
It always happens. And in fact, in this episode, we're going to turn the tables and I'm going to interview you.
Oh, no.
Because this last
weekend, save me.
I just finished reading your new book, Undone, subtitled A Story of Making Peace with an Unexpected Life. And I want to tell you, I was deeply moved by this book. And we talk about clarity and courage and commitment. And this book gave me all three. And so I'm going to ask you some questions about the book.
Thank you. First of all, thank you. Because it's
welcome.
Very nerve-wracking when people that you admire and respect are reading what you wrote. It feels very exposing. So thank you for
well,
that.
Well, you know, when you agree to review a book and possibly do an endorsement, it's always a little bit scary for the person who's doing that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because what
True.
If I read the book and don't like it? You know, how am I going to tell you that? But fortunately, in your case, I loved it. This book is a memoir. So
yes,
this
it is.
In fact, let me ask you the question. How's a memoir different from an autobiography?
Well, that's a very good question. Autobiography, typically, from what I understand, would follow more of just kind of a timeline of events, like a chronology. A lot of times, like it's a whole chunk, like a major portion of the life from birth till whenever. Memoir is really taking a selection out of life, maybe a year. Sometimes it can be only a few months. In my case, it's 2 years. So it's really just a slice of 2 years of life that I've written about in one book and kind of conveying a certain theme. So it's not just about conveying facts about my life, but it's really very thematic and very much connecting with real life for the reader.
Yeah.
Not just about telling my story. It's really about the reader's story.
Well, and part of what I loved about the way you told the stories in this book, and the book is full of stories, is that I found myself in your story. So it gave me clarity about my own story and
mm-hmm.
about the fact that I'm living in a larger story that encompasses both our stories.
True.
And I think that's just the power of story.
Very, very true. And there's a fine line because, you know, sometimes books can just seem like somebody's just sitting around talking about themselves.
Right.
Which I'm sure has its purpose and some people like that. But what my heart was, I didn't have any like dire need to just sit and disclose my personal life. It really had to have a different purpose. And the purpose was exactly what you just said, to make sure that we realize that we really have interconnected stories and that even though our stories, some of the details are different, we really are in very similar scenarios. And if we can learn together and work together and partner together through that, it really changes the stories as a whole.
Amen to that. Well, without further ado, let's get into some of the stories. So
okay.
I want you to start with the story of your Thanksgiving in 2010.
All right. Well, in 2010, it was November 2010. And Thanksgiving, I should start by saying Thanksgiving has long been my favorite holiday, like hands down.
Because you like to cook, for starters.
I love to cook. There's something about Thanksgiving that's so unadulterated by commercialism.
Yep.
I mean, it's so pure. The heart of it is really about gratitude and family, and it's just very positive. Mm. So hands down, my favorite holiday is Thanksgiving.
True for me, too.
Love it.
Love it.
And so anytime November comes around, I start building up for Thanksgiving. Cannot wait. We usually have about 30 people over to the house. I cook a huge meal. It's a big ordeal. However, in 2010, it got derailed by a phone call. 2 days before Thanksgiving, and I was literally an hour from leaving the house to go buy groceries for the meal, the phone rang. It was 8:30 in the morning, and it was a doctor that I had gone to see the week before. I had an ulcer in my mouth, on my tongue, that just would not heal. And so he had tried different things to get it resolved, different kinds of medication did not work. So he decided as a last resort to do a biopsy. But he reassured me in the office, Michelle, it's fine. I can guarantee you there's nothing wrong. You're okay. I'm just doing this as part of protocol. Until Tuesday morning, 2 days before Thanksgiving, when the phone rang and his first words to me were, Michelle, it's not good. And that's
never a good thing to hear from your doctor.
Never a good thing. I will never forget hearing those words. And in an instant, and just like that fast, I mean, just a split second, I went from having a life that seemed pretty ordinary to having a life and death scenario that was in front of me. I heard the word cancer for the first time. And that rocked me to my core. So that year, Thanksgiving, ceased to be about Thanksgiving and was really more about my panic about this fact that I was now facing cancer. And what would I do with that? And would I be around the next Thanksgiving? And
wow.
I immediately started thinking of what was to come. And I basically almost missed Thanksgiving itself because I was so caught up in the drama that was ahead of me.
Well, before we get to that, does your mind typically run to the worst case scenario?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I actually think I should have a degree for that because I'm so good at it. I always anticipate or imagine the worst case scenario.
Yeah, I do too.
There's something about my mind that thinks that if I can imagine the worst case and kind of deal with it, then I'm okay.
Yeah.
But what I end up doing is kind of taunting myself with all of these unnecessary fears that haven't even come to be yet.
So what did Thanksgiving look like from the moment of that phone call until something shifted?
Well, so I ended up that Tuesday. I still went grocery shopping. My family arrived, but I kind of walked through those next couple days like a zombie because all I could think about was the doctor's phone call, the appointments that were coming up. And I remember Thanksgiving morning. I got up early like I always did. I prepared food, but I was in such a state of panic and anxiety that I wasn't enjoying the day. I was like going through the...
You weren't present.
No, I wasn't present. I was going through the motions, but I was not enjoying the day. And at some point, I finished the meal. Everybody gathered to give thanks before the meal. Everybody started filling their plates and going to sit at the table. And I was so maxed out with emotion and fear and worry that I ran upstairs and hid in my bedroom and just started crying.
Oh.
And what really turned things around for me is that my husband came upstairs. He noticed I was absent. He followed me upstairs, came to the bedroom, and simply just held me, let me cry, and told me it's going to be okay.
Hmm.
Just that little word. And it wasn't enough to kind of cure me of the fear, but it was enough to just get me back to the table.
Wow.
But the big lesson of that day is that I wanted somebody to give me reassurances for the next decades of my life. I wanted to have God deliver this big, huge promise that everything was going to be okay. And instead, what often happens is we get just enough for one meal. We get just enough of reassurance for that one day. And that's what he gave. He gave me my husband, who came to tell me, I love you. I'm not leaving you. It's going to be okay. And it was enough to get me back to the table so that hopefully, as I went forward through this process, I wouldn't miss the feast in front of me because of what I was afraid of coming down the road.
Such an important lesson. I can't remember if it's right after that you talk about it or if it's in that story that you use the example of the Israelites wandering through the desert and God bringing them manna.
Yes.
So talk about how that that relates to your story.
That's a huge theme through the story because so in the Old Testament, the Israelites are wandering in the wilderness and they're out there kind of lost. God's directing them, but because they're in the desert in the wilderness, they don't have access to food. But God promises, I'm going to give you manna every single day, but he gave them a couple requirements. He said, you can only collect enough for today. You have to trust me that I'm going to give you more tomorrow. And he promised them, I'll give you more tomorrow, but you can't collect any more. Well, in typical fashion, like most of us are, they still wanted to collect. You know, they pulled out their Tupperware, right? They started collecting as much manna as they could cram into their Tupperware, and they took it back to their tents, and it was rotten by the next morning. But the good news is God still delivered new manna the next day. But they were in such a place of they wanted to hoard and create provisions for the future rather than living day by day. And that's really what I was doing. When faced with a completely unexpected scenario, I wanted to gather enough for weeks to come, not just today. And God was constantly reminding me that you can only live in today. I'm going to deliver what you need for today, and you have to trust me that I'm going to deliver manna enough for tomorrow.
Is that a lesson that you learned at that Thanksgiving and that was kind of the end of it?
Sorry as I laugh. No.
I feel normal.
That was the first exposure to that lesson, but I mean, I'm still learning it. I mean, I'm still having to learn that lesson even now. But I can tell you that I've had lots of practice, and it's getting a little bit easier to just embrace today's manna and not think too much about tomorrow. Because the truth is for the last 4 years since that first diagnosis, he's provided manna every single day. That's more than 1,200 days of manna that I've seen him deliver, so I know he can do it again tomorrow.
How does gratitude fit into all of this? I mean, you're talking about Thanksgiving, and even as we're recording this, it's right before Thanksgiving. So how does gratitude fit into this whole journey that you've had over the last 2 years with so many ups and downs and twists and turns?
Oh, yeah. There have been quite a few ups and downs and twists and turns. Well, gratitude in many ways is my lifeline. Because when you're in a position where you've lost so much, where every time you turn around, you're losing something else, it can be very easy to focus on all that's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, you can just see, it's like you just look around and see carnage. Everywhere you look, you see all these different things that you've lost, things that you will never get back. And there's so much grief that's a part of that. The only way to push through grief really is to eventually come to some place where you see what you still have left.
Mm.
So either I can focus on all that I've lost, or I can start to identify, recognize what I still have.
Yeah, that's really good.
And that's not easy done.
Nope.
So I don't want it to sound trite. I mean, that's work. That's serious work. But, you know, part of my surgery meant that I lost some function of speech. I lost some function of eating ability. I lost my ignorance. Being able to naively live thinking that cancer wouldn't happen to me, that only happens to other people. I lost all those things, which were huge things to grieve.
Right.
Massive. Or I could focus on the fact that, gosh, I have two legs that can go outside and go for a walk.
Yeah.
And I've got a family. How many people don't have a family to support them through things like this? And I live in the United States where I have access to great health care. How many people don't have that?
Yeah.
And I could just start making a list of all the ways that I was incredibly blessed. And what it did is it just kind of, it weighed the scales differently. And so rather than it being such a huge weight of how much I'd lost, now all of a sudden the scales weighed pretty heavy with what I still had.
Yeah, that's really good. So just in your own story, and just so we kind of have the thread that weaves all this together, you went from that revelation from the doctor that you had cancer, you had a surgery.
Yes.
And then how did it roll forward from there?
All right. So it was just, you know, that was just the beginning of the drama. Here I thought that was going to wrap it up. And really, it was just the very, very tip of the iceberg. So I had surgery on December 10th, which kind of launched me into a long recovery process. So that surgery involved taking out part of my tongue, which sounds very horrific, and it really is. But you just can't eat the same, swallow the same, talk the same. So the recovery after that's pretty significant.
And oh, by the way, you make your living talking.
Yes, I make my living as a speaker, a communicator. Not to mention I have a whole house full of kids. So, you know, it's helpful when you can talk.
Talk about the resistance.
Yeah, exactly. So then after that happened, I moved, you know, Christmas rolled around, then New Year's. And when New Year's happened, I wanted cancer to be part of 2010. So, I mean, I slammed the door on cancer. It was last year. It's not 2011. I'm not taking it with me. We're done with that. I kind of packed it up, put it to the side. However, what I didn't anticipate is how kind of the fear from that would move forward with me.
Wondering if it would come back.
Yes. So once you've been diagnosed with something like that, there's always this fear that, you know, it's like you just keep waiting. Every time you feel any kind of twinge of pain anywhere on your body, you think it must be a tumor.
Yeah, exactly.
It must be cancer again. So you're constantly kind of hypervigilant about waiting for the axe to fall again. You know, you lose your naivete. And so all of a sudden now the worst can happen.
And you're being hypervigilant now about your health and what you're eating.
Exactly.
And wondering if when you walk outside, if you breathe the air in Denver, if that's going to...
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
It was kind of funny how it was actually rather comical, how paranoid I got. I was afraid to inhale if I was walking down a busy street because the exhaust might cause it to come back, or afraid to eat certain foods because that might cause it to come back. And it just was a new experience for me to understand how much that fear and anxiety really is even a tougher battle to beat than the cancer itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So about this time, though, you're starting to look forward to the fact that you and Troy, your husband, are going to be empty nesters.
Yes.
You're about to take your combined family of three children, and you're going to graduate them, and they're going to fly the coop, and you'll be back with your...
Woohoo! Now, you know what I call empty nest, right?
No.
I call empty nest the promised land.
Yes. You did say that in the manuscript.
It's the promised land because, you know, once you have had three teenage boys for an extended period of time, I mean, you are thinking milk and honey, baby, milk and honey. You just cannot wait to get there.
Hallelujah chorus.
Exactly. And we were almost there. So December was the surgery. We go into the 2011. Our second son is just about ready to graduate from high school. So at this point, we already have one out of high school. Our second son is just about ready to graduate from high school. school. We go to his graduation. And let me tell you, by the way,
this and you've been the rain?
Yes, this was in the rain. It was pouring down rain that day. I mean, we're talking sheets of rain. But we were not going to miss that because we were so happy to have two-thirds of our children graduated. We were not going to miss it. So we're standing in the bleachers in the rain, cheering for him. And my husband and I turn at each other partway through and just give each other a high five because we were like, we're almost there. And so we were celebrating. We immediately, over the next couple months, start talking about Empty Nest. We sold our family car and got a smaller sedan. We started planning what we were going to do to the house once the bedrooms were freed up. we were just like full bore going into this Empty Nest phase until July 19th. And on July 19th, the phone rang again. By the way, I've come to a place I don't like answering the phone.
I've noticed that.
I do know. So the phone rang again July 19th, 2 months to the day after our son graduated from high school. And this time it was someone telling us about a mother who could no longer take care of her children. So she had twin 4-year-olds and a 5-year-old. And the question was asked of us, will you take them? Mm. And my wonderful, mature response was, no, I don't want to take them.
Are you kidding?
Are you kidding me? I'm almost done. And that's when really the second unexpected boulder dropped right in the middle of our life. And my husband and I, as much as we wanted to deny it or the sense of, not that we wanted to deny it, we wanted a comfortable life. Yeah. We'd been through a lot. And yet at the same time, one thing we'd learned from cancer is that life is so very fragile and that when we live for others, that's really legacy.
Yeah.
So much more valuable than so many ways that we spend our time.
And these kids needed a stable home.
Yes.
You had one you could give
yes.
them.
It was us or foster care.
Yeah.
It was us or foster care. And so we, 24 hours later, we packed up what we called our empty nest car, our tiny little 4-person sedan with 3 borrowed car seats that were crammed in the back seat. And we drove to another state and we picked up 3 children and started parenting all over.
You obviously had a serious case of amnesia at this point, having forgotten what it's like to have small children. So
True.
How did your life change
True.
In the next 30 days?
Well, you know, the funny thing is even as we were driving back from picking them up, I kept looking in the back seat, like double checking. I'm like, oh, they're still there. Oh, no, they're still sitting there. And the funniest thing is looking back and seeing 3 pairs of eyes looking at you like, okay, what are you going to do with
What's
us
next?
Now? Exactly. So over that next, gosh, just over the next week, our mostly adult home was covered with children's books and toys everywhere. We had to go out and buy plastic sippy cups. You know how long it had been since we had a sippy cup in
wow,
our house?
Yeah.
I had to start tying children's shoes again and cutting up their meat and, tucking kids into bed and doing baths.
It's like deja vu.
Oh, my goodness.
And live it all over
all
again.
These things you forgot. And let me tell you, once you've gotten past that phase, it's not a whole lot fun going back.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So you tell one great story in the book. You tell a lot of great stories in the books, but you tell this one about your tradition of on Christmas Eve, you go to the homeless shelter, and then you go to the big Methodist church in downtown Denver for a Christmas Eve service.
Yes.
And so this now you have not only your 3 older children, but now these 3 what you call the littles
yes.
with you. So now it's 6 of you plus Troy. You get to church just a little bit late because, let's be honest, it's not easy to get everybody ready and get everybody out the door on time. You get to church a little bit late. All the chairs are mostly taken.
Yes.
And so to get your family in one spot looks impossible. Pick it up from there.
All right. So, you know, this is a tradition we do every year. It's very much a key part of our holiday. Probably the most important is going to Trinity downtown to church on Christmas Eve. So we can't find anywhere to sit. And I mean, we actually brought one of our son's girlfriends. So there were 9 of us. And you don't want to split up on Christmas Eve. And so we were like, what are we going to do? Do we leave? Do we split up? What do we do? And this woman noticed that we were trying to find a seat, this older woman, and she came and grabbed us and said, I know where you can go. Follow me. And so we started following her, and she took us down a hallway and through a door. And I'm thinking she's going to take us up to the balcony, that maybe she found a row up there for us. And she opens one more door, and we see a whole bunch of chairs, and she points out there and tells us to go out there and sit. And we walk out. And wouldn't you know it, we're on the stage in the choir loft. She has sat.
You can't make this stuff up.
She sat our family of 9 including three very small children, on the stage in front of an auditorium filled with like 600 people.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, okay, this is just disaster waiting to happen. Yep. You don't put three small children at 11 o'clock at night on a stage in front of people. I mean, it's going to be a show. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to be the show people showed up for.
Exactly.
And so Troy and I, we start sitting us, alternating us, grown children with small children and adults, trying to do what we can to prevent any disasters. And the whole time we're thinking, oh, they're going to seat more people mm-hmm. on the stage too. There's a bunch of chairs and they're just going to bring all the latecomers up here. No, the Cachette family were the only people on the stage for the entire Christmas Eve service.
And the bona fide choir members are sitting in front of you.
Yes.
But occasionally glancing back, wondering what you're doing in their space.
Yes. Like, are we new soloists or what are we? What are we doing there?
Wow.
I mean, it blew my mind.
So what was the big takeaway?
So the irony is this kind of all happened shortly after the kids moved in and we're just adjusting. And quite frankly, when you take three brand new humans into an existent family, everything changes and it's startling. I mean, it's I'll worthy bet. And it's good. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's a worthy thing and we'd do it all over again. But to acquire three new family members and try to get them to blend and adapt with your current family is, it is traumatic for everybody involved. And there were moments, let's just be honest, that I think, what did we do? What did we do? I don't have the energy for this. I don't have the time. We don't have the space. What are we doing? And then all of that happened. We arrive at the church that's completely full. And the sweet woman, who we never saw again, showed us to the one place where there was room. And as I sat there on the stage, my sweet little four-year-old, she laid her head on my lap and fell asleep during Christmas Eve service. And I started to think of the whole Christmas story and where Mary and Joseph end up in Bethlehem in an inn that didn't have any room. And they ended up someplace they didn't expect, in a stable, giving birth to the Savior.
Wow.
And it hit me that I don't want to be the innkeeper that says I don't have room. Because there are times when something divine is right there on your doorstep, and if you turn it away, you will miss out on the miracle.
So this really reinforced for you or strengthened your resolve to bring these children into your family and do for them what nobody else was either willing or could do for them at this time.
That sometimes you have to make room for what's uncomfortable and unexpected because there's a miracle there.
Yeah. Well, there's more to come. More stories, great stories. I can't wait to get into what we're going to talk about in the second segment, but first we're going to take a break.
As a busy and successful blogger, podcaster, author, speaker, and consultant, I'm constantly asked about the tools I use to get it all done. Now, for the first time, I'm going to pull back the curtain and let you peek inside my toolbox to see the software and hardware I use for everything from blogging and podcasting to productivity, social media, and speaking, plus so much more. You can't buy Inside My Toolbox, but you can get it for free by subscribing to my free email newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll receive my newest content right in your inbox. You'll never have to worry about missing an important post or update again. To get your free copy of the Inside My Toolbox ebook, visit michaelhyatt.com and enter your name and email address into the form on the page. Don't waste any more time or money using the wrong tools. Sign up today at michaelhyatt.com.
Okay, Michelle, we've talked about Thanksgiving 2010. We talked about this phone call that you didn't expect. We talked about what you learned through that. And we talked about this crazy experience of being on stage Christmas Eve with these three little children and how that really strengthened your resolve to make room in the inn, so to speak.
Yes.
What I want to talk about now is what happened with your health. Now, you're dealing with this new family. You thought you were done.
Yes.
Now you're right back at the starting line again. Mm-hmm. But your health is still a problem.
Yes, it continues to be a challenge. You know, you think that that lightning doesn't strike more than once in the same place, but I discovered that's absolutely not true, that sometimes challenges keep happening even if you think you're at your max capacity. So after the cancer surgery, I continued to go to the doctor for my regular appointments, but what ended up happening is I ended up having some complications from the surgery that forced me to have multiple procedures after. It wasn't cancer necessarily, it was more of a cyst that formed, but I ended up having three additional surgeries in April, July, July and August, even as we were taking in these children and acquire them into our family and making all those adjustments.
You didn't need this right now.
No, no. It would have been really nice if I would have gotten a like get out of jail free card for that and not had to deal with it. So I'm continuing to go through very, very painful procedures to fix this continual issue. I'm going through constant healing process while I'm learning to parent three children all over again.
And you're thinking this whole time, I mean, I'm sure every time the cancers come back.
Oh, every single time. That fear and anxiety was always there. So every doctor's appointment, every PET scan, every time I had to go under the knife, it was always, it's the cancer, it's cancer, it's back.
So you're right on the edge of panic.
Every single time.
So let's fast forward to this dive in Santa Rosa in Mexico.
Yes. So after about, I think it was about a year or so, my parents offered to come stay with the children to give us a break. It was just a very exhausting year for us, making all of these adaptations and dealing with the health things and all of that. And so my parents said, let us come. You and Troy take off. Go get a break. And so we booked just a really inexpensive trip to Mexico where we could literally sit on the beach and sleep and then do some diving. We've long been certified scuba divers. So
and
we
you
were
needed
in the diving.
This rest, just a change of scenery.
Oh, yeah, something. Just to kind of refuel. And so we went on a dive, and we've been diving for 10 years at this point. So we were very experienced. We'd done tons of dives. It was nothing new. And so we go out on this dive. We get on the boat, and then we all start to go in the water and start to descend down to our starting point. And this is one of our favorite dives. It's called the Santa Rosa, just off of Cozumel. And it's like our favorite. Mm. And so we go all the way down to the bottom. We start our dive.
It's like 80 feet down.
In fact, we've done this dive before. So it wasn't even new. It was just, but it's one of our favorites. So we were doing it again. And then all of a sudden, just a few minutes into it, I start noticing that my heart is just pounding out of my chest and I can't get it to stop. And then I start to notice that I can't breathe. It's like I can't get oxygen. And so I know I have my tank on, I have my regulator in, and I'm trying really hard to breathe, but it's like I can't get air. And then I'm really panicking. And I'm frantic, flailing around in the water. I'm trying to find-
You can't go up.
Well, my impulse was to go up, but I knew for a fact that if I shot up, it would kill me. But at
just
that
a decompression
point,
process, yeah.
But my impulse was, I was panicked. I couldn't breathe. I needed to go up. So I'm searching all around for the dive master. I'm looking for my husband. I couldn't find anybody. And I think, this is it. And I remember thinking, how ironic to survive cancer only to die underneath the ocean. I really think it's done. And just about the time, I mean, I'm to the point where I'm about ready to pull my own regulator out of my mouth. I'm not even thinking.
So irrational.
Yeah, totally irrational. And I knew this. Again, I've had 10 years experience. And just about the time where I think I'm done, the dive master shows up and he's standing right in front of me. And he makes eye contact. Of course, we can't talk. We're underwater. He grabs my hand. He checks all my equipment, makes sure it's working, grabs my hand, looks me in the eye, and makes me make eye contact with him. And then he just rubs my hand and holds me like that for just about a minute and a half or so.
Wow.
And there was something about that him being there with me in it, forcing me to look at him, that calmed my heart down.
Wow.
Now, what I learned later, what had happened is I basically had a panic attack 80 feet under the ocean. Not something I would recommend.
Or the place to do it.
No, exactly. I mean, it's horrifying enough just normally, but to have that happen there was worse. And what I eventually unpacked is we had had crisis after crisis after crisis, trauma after trauma. I never really had time to emotionally or physically recover from any of this. Mm-hmm. And my body was just shutting down. So when I go on vacation and had time to rest, it protested.
Wow.
And basically shut down.
And you talked about in the experience later on, you talk about in the book just dealing with anxiety and kind of coming to terms with that. What do you want to share about that?
I don't want to share about that.
But you already did in the book. So
I did in the book, so I have to hear. Yeah, you know, I'm a firstborn achiever. Nothing kind of intimidates me. I'm going to conquer the world person until I hit this position where I realized that I couldn't fix myself, that this kind of process of all these different traumas had taken such a toll on me that just just going for a run or eating a salad or taking a nap or even taking a vacation wasn't going to cure this, that this was bigger than that. And that meant I needed outside help. And boy, it's hard for me to ask for outside help. And this really forced me to a place where I had to realize that I needed a team. I couldn't do this on my own.
So you felt a little guilty about it?
Yes.
But asking for the help. But you got the help.
Yeah. So I went to see my counselor. I went to see my therapist. That was really a big start. And just to affirm the fact that this really was a panic attack that was going on. In fact, I ended up having three total panic attacks over the course of about 3 months. And it wasn't going away. And so I ended up needing to go to the doctor and get a prescription for just anxiety, because what had happened over time had compounded to the point that my physical body was not able to deal with it anymore.
And there are those situations, and I think this is a good takeaway, where we do need outside help. It may not always be a prescription, but sometimes it may mean that.
Sometimes it is.
And we have to avail of ourselves of the resources that we have, use those, and you did. And I think it's it will give encouragement to people who may find themselves in that situation and just need something to kind of stabilize and get on the road to recovery and get on the road to whatever they need next.
One thing I want to say on that is my thought was that I was weak. The fact that I had to do this meant that I wasn't strong enough. And I kept asking my question. The question I would ask myself was, what's wrong with you, Michelle, that you can't do this? What's wrong with you? Yeah. And it wasn't the right question. I eventually learned how to be a little kinder to myself. Well, of course you're exhausted. Look what has happened. Look what's gone on. And to offer that grace to yourself a little bit more and understand that, you know, truth strength is being willing to say, okay, this is bigger than me. I need some help.
Well, one of the great gifts of a memoir is that it gives you perspective. I started with that.
Yes.
And I want to finish with a story that you talk about where you bought some markers for the children. And you naively, and I could totally see myself in this situation, thought that they could entertain themselves for maybe an hour or so while you got some much needed work done. And so you left them in the other room, but they were within earshot, and you left them with the markers. And what happened next?
Well, I think I might have gotten sucked into the vortex of social media or something a little longer than a half an hour. And I returned to the dining room, how should I say, to find my dining room redecorated. There was red marker on the walls. There was purple marker on the trim. There was so much marker everywhere. And the irony is there was no children to be found. It was just redecoration. They had kind of done their little job and then they had disappeared. And when you have gone from having pretty much an adult house where you're controlling all the details to having that happen again, I was livid. I was like, okay, what did they do? Where did they go? So I immediately start calling for my children and call them in here and say, who did this? And so I found the culprit. Of course, the other two turned on the one who had done it.
I love your description of her, too, as she admitted to it. You said, I think you said her, like her little bottom lip started sticking out.
Oh, yeah. She's like, yeah, you can't really be mad at me. So she sat there and she finally admitted to doing it. And she gave me this look like, what's the big deal? I colored your walls for you. Like, yeah. I should give her an award.
I'm not charging you.
Exactly.
It's original art.
And that scene right there really described what happened to our lives over the year before.
Wow.
I mean, really, that describes it. We went from having nice, clean, white walls, very predictable, organized, orderly life, to having marker everywhere.
Which looked like a mess.
It looked like a complete mess. I mean, if you would have looked at my life, I mean, even now, you could come and look at my life, and it looks like it's in disarray. I mean, it's chaos. We have children everywhere, and we have all these different things going on, and health things going on, and it looked like a total mess.
But you beautifully relate it to, what do you go back to, like 1874 or something?
Yeah, 1874. So one day I started doing just a little research as I was doing some blogging and writing. I stumbled across an article about the birth of Impressionism, which was in 1874. And when Impressionistic artists started painting their pictures, they really wanted to use more bold colors and more kind of like the bold colors would bump up against each other, and it was more
messy
and blunt, and it didn't flow and blend. And so if you stood really close to a piece of Impressionistic art, it looked like a mess. I mean, it wasn't clean.
Yeah.
But, however, those that learned to appreciate Impressionism learned that it was best viewed from a little bit of distance. Mm. That if you just step back a little bit, all the kind of messiness starts to blend and bleed together and creates motion. And all of a sudden, something that just looks like splotches of paint turns into an ocean with waves that's actually moving.
Wow.
But it was all about vantage point. And when I read that article, I realized that's what I need to do. I'm standing too close to my canvas.
Wow.
I got to step back, and then I'm going to see it differently.
So it really is a matter of perspective. And sometimes when we're so close to our life and we're living this stuff and it's up close and personal, it does look like a mess and we lose perspective and we want to quit. But by stepping away, you're able to get a little more perspective on your life. And at least for this day.
For that day.
For that day, you can make it through to the next day.
That's really how we learn to appreciate story. If we look at just one particular chapter, one particular scene, we can get really overcome with the weight of what's happening in that moment. But if we can step back and see the overall transition and flow of the story that's taking shape in our life, all of a sudden it becomes something that's quite a beautiful piece of art. But you just can't look at it one slice at a time. You got to see the overall whole. And when you do, you realize that there's an artist that's weaving all things together for some kind of glorious end and that you get to experience it. But you got to step back and take that kind of vantage point.
Yeah, I love it. Well, and your story is long from over. There's much that happened, not only in the rest of the book, but much that happened since the book finished.
Yes.
But I want to thank you for just taking a few minutes and sharing this with us. And I normally at the end of the show, we call people to go review the podcast and do all this stuff. But I just want to say this. The book is Undone, The Story of Making Peace with an Unexpected Life. And the call to action that I want to make to you who are listening is go buy this book. Go to Amazon, your favorite retailer, whatever. This is a book that will give you clarity, will give you courage, will give you the commitment that we always talk about. But more than anything, just to recognize, and I think Michelle's a beautiful illustration of this, is your life is a gift. Now go do what matters.